As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
You guys, I am so excited. My new course on behavior, the Practical Behavior Approach, is officially done and ready to go. Enrollment is only open until April 30th. And if you are someone who is supporting a child with frequent challenging behaviors, listen in because this course is for you. This course was designed for any teacher, special ed or gen ed, clinician or parent, working with a child with frequent negative behaviors. This course is going to prepare you with a comprehensive toolbox. You're going to have all the tools you need to prevent problem behaviors, respond when problem behaviors happen, and to build those missing skills. We go in depth into why behavior happens, looking at contributing factors like diagnosis, trauma, anxiety, and sensory needs. This is truly a cohesive course where strategies are rooted in the science of applied behavior analysis, but also rooted in trauma-informed practices. So you're going to have both perspectives to develop this really robust framework of strategies that is truly going to be effective. So if you are feeling burnt out, overwhelmed, or out of answers on how to support your kids, click on the link in the show notes and learn a little bit more about this course and how the training and all of the downloads and tools are going to really help support you on this journey to helping your child be successful. I can't fully express how excited I am to get this course in your hands. Click on the link in show notes. Let me know if you have any questions. And when you get started, let me know how it goes.
Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper Podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism.
Today, we're going to be diving into a big and important topic, and we're going to talk about how this topic can work in a public school setting. So today, we're talking about practical functional assessment and skills-based treatment. This process was developed by Dr. Greg Hanley as an alternative for handling and treating severe problem behavior. Today in the podcast, I am joined by three staff members who recently piloted this process at their school district. Lisa Zagas, the Assistant Superintendent for Student Services, and two student service coordinators, Courtney Peters and Megan Palambella, who helped implement and really run with the implementation of PFA and SBT in their school district. If you are unfamiliar with what these strategies are, they give a great overview of what practical functional assessment is, how it's different than other traditional behavior approaches, and they go in depth into really how to implement this into a public school setting. What are the challenges? How do we get staff buy-in? How do you even get started? I love the advice they give, and they explain everything in a very user-friendly way. And my favorite part is really hearing about the great successes that they are having in the school setting, how it's really changed their mindset, their approach to challenging behavior, and how staff are really getting all bought in on this process as well. So let's go ahead and hear from Lisa, Courtney, and Megan. Hello, guys. Welcome to the Autism Helper Podcast. I'm so excited to have all three of you on for a conversation about practical functional assessment and skills-based treatment in schools. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd love to have each of you quickly introduce yourself since we have three guests on today, share kind of what your role is in the schools.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us. We're excited. I'm Lisa Exegas. I currently serve as the Assistant Superintendent for Student Services for the Naperville School District in Naperville, Illinois, which is right outside of Chicago. And I'm thrilled that we're talking about this topic with you today.
Yep, I'm Courtney Peters. I'm a Student Services Coordinator and a member of the Trauma Invested Behavior Support Team in Naperville 203. So I get to work with Megan and Lisa regularly, and it's fantastic. Thanks for having us.
I'm Megan Palambala. I'm also a Student Services Coordinator, primarily working with the early childhood age, and I work with Courtney and Lisa.
Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. I think this is a really important topic, and I like that there's so much more discussion about PFA in the school setting. I mean, really, it's great that we're just talking about ABA in general in the school setting, but especially how these really important strategies can work in, you know, a crowded, complicated public school. So to get us started, let's kind of start at the foundation. Can you describe what skills-based treatment is and how who's using it within and in like school-friendly terms? Like what is this idea here?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that one. And my colleagues already made fun of me because I wrote out like quite a long description of this because it is complex. And I want to make sure that we're hitting all the points here. And practical functional assessment and SBT go together. And there's just really tons of acronyms that go along with this process. So PFA is the practical functional assessment. And that's the first thing that you do when you get started on skill-based treatment, which is SBT. And when you start with the PFA, you always start with interviews and not observations. And that's the first major thing that makes it different in the school setting. So typically, if we were called in, if a kid was having difficulties with problem behavior, it would be really heavy on observations to try to figure out what was going on. When we're using this model, we're relying on those reports from the people who know the kid the best. So you're starting with interviews. You're kind of a detective through those interviews. You're trying to figure out what makes the behavior turn on and what makes it turn off. A favorite question during those interviews is, if you had $1 million and you there was a lot on the line, what could you do to start the behavior and what could you do to turn the behavior off? So in the teaching setting, sometimes it would be, hey, your administrator's walking down the hallway. If you have a perfect observation, then you get a tropical vacation. The kid is about to melt down. What can you do to keep that kid from melting down or to keep that kid from having a problem behavior? And typically when you ask those sorts of questions, the caregivers know, the teachers know, the parents know, they know what to do. They just haven't been given the confidence or the permission to turn those behaviors off because there's that fear of reinforcing problem behavior. So once you have that interview done, then you go into the PFA, that practical functional assessment piece. And in the school setting, we usually do it in a separate classroom or an office. You have two different parts of the room set up. One part is that synthesized reinforcement context. So you have all the things that you identified through the reinforcement that kid loves, things that they love to do that really helps them to be happy, relaxed, and engaged. HRE is another popular acronym for this treatment. So that's one part of the room, all of the kids' favorite things. And then the other part of the room is arranged to have different things that can be triggers for that student's problem behavior. So sometimes we call that the table of high expectations. And you might have that table set up with the things that the kid is expected to do. Maybe it's part of the kid's IEP goals, a certain academic task that the kid doesn't like, but things that have pretty reliably evoked problem behavior in the past. And when the kid comes into that assessment, you get the kid settled into HRE. And then so they're happy, relaxed, and engaged in that synthesized reinforcement, again, with all of those things that the kid loves to have and loves to do. And then you introduce demands in a really structured way until you get problem behavior. And as soon as you get any sort of problem behavior, whether it's a really big dangerous behavior or a small baby precursor behavior, you reinforce that and return them to the reinforcement context. And you kind of bounce the kid back and forth from that reinforcement context to progressing the establishing operation or the EO. So basically back and forth from reinforcement to the table of high expectations until you've demonstrated that you can turn the behavior on and off 4 times. Typically during that process, the behavior is shaped down because the kid has realized, I don't need to put all this effort into having these really high intensity, big explosive behaviors if they're going to be responding by reinforcing my smaller, less effort, like precursor behaviors. So you kind of shape that behavior down in that process. The reason that you do the assessment is By demonstrating that you can turn that behavior off consistently, you've demonstrated that you can move forward safely with the skills-based treatment process. So that's really the most important thing, because safety is priority throughout this whole experience. And that's really become one of our values as a district as well. We also are using that assessment context to make sure that everything in the synthesized reinforcement context, everything that the kid needs to be HRE is there. So if the student's walking out or having behavior during the reinforcement context, or if you really just can't get them HRE, happy, relaxed, and engaged, then something isn't quite right. And you need to take a step back and do some more detective work to figure out what's missing. The last part of why we do the assessment is it's the very beginning of forming a relationship with that student where we have rapport together, we have trust together, and I'm showing you that your behavior is really powerful. Your behavior is communication. I'm not pushing you through. I'm taking for granted. I'm believing you. If your behavior is showing me this is too hard, this is too much, I don't like this, I can't do it, I'm going to believe you, and I'm going to say, okay, you don't have to do this right now. You can go back to reinforcement. Typically, these assessments are done within 30 minutes to an hour. I don't know that we've had any that have lasted over an hour in our district so far. So when you compare that to the traditional FBA model, like, what a breath of fresh air. Like, that is just, it's so much faster, and you get some really good information. After we have the assessment done, then we move into SBT. So traditionally, when you are working with kids who have severe problem behavior in the schools, a lot of our interactions are really transactional. So the teacher might start with some sort of ask or some sort of demand, and then they would want the kid to do a behavior that we like a motor imitation, matching, or more complex things like writing essays, doing complex math problems. But we're asking, they perform, and then we reinforce that. If a kid has problem behavior in the traditional model, we might push through them or withhold reinforcement until we get that student to comply. In some circumstances, we might try to introduce arbitrary reinforcement through some sort of token economy, or in like a really good situation, we might even try to match the reinforcer with whatever our perceived function of that problem behavior is. So for example, if we think this kid is scratching because he's trying to escape from his work, then we might have the kid working for breaks to escape from his work in a more positive way. In this model, we have a lot of first then cycles, and we have students choose what they're quote unquote working for. And they might pick like one thing like the iPad for 5 minutes or something like that. And there's a huge emphasis on compliance. And there's this assumption made that students can do these things. They're just choosing not to, or they have like a lack of motivation. And so they need that external reinforcement kind of dangled in front of them like a carrot to do things. SBT kind of flips that on its head. So in SBT, skills-based treatment, we're going to start with the give. So when the kid comes to session, we're going to allow them to settle into reinforcement right away. And that's where we're going to start. So the kid might come into the room, sit in his favorite rocking chair. He might be rocking back and forth, jamming to Lady Gaga, singing along and watching YouTube videos about like diesel train engines or like whatever floats his boat, like whatever his thing is, he's settling into that. And once the kid is happy, relaxed, and engaged, that's when we would start to introduce demands in really small and manageable chunks. And we're going to build up like along a trunk of a tree. So we're these ready to learn skills as communication, toleration, relinquishing, and transitioning. We're teaching those skills in really incremental small chunks that are manageable to the student and are allowing the kid to make progress in a way that is doesn't feel really scary to them. It's not too difficult for them. And after they master their skill, or after they request or get to whatever it is we're reinforcing on that step, we let them go back to reinforcement, and not just the one thing that we've said they're working for. We let them to go back to all of those favorite things that he likes doing. In SBT, the data sheets, like the structure of it is set up so we're intermittently reinforcing. So we're not always, let's say the target for our session is transitioning. We're going to reinforce transitioning some of the time, but we're not forgetting about those steps beforehand. We're not forgetting about communication, toleration, relinquishing. We're also going to be reinforcing those steps some of the time. So it's really important that we follow those data sheets and you follow the process to make sure that you're not losing those skills that the kid's already mastered. And then we increase those expectations until there's adequate fluency in those skills so they can be reinforced in whatever their environment is. And then there is a plan for generalization as well in this process. So when I think about like a metaphor for SBT versus a traditional model, like if you imagine a kid in treatment sessions is kind of like floating in a glass of ice water, if it's a traditional model, the ice water, like the water part is the demands. The kid is mostly floating around in like demands, and occasionally he might bump into an ice cube, and that ice cube is reinforcement. So most of the time he's spent in that demand context with just bumps into reinforcement. And SBT, we flip that around. So if in an SBT session, if you imagine that the kid is floating in a glass of ice water, the water itself is the reinforcement. That's where he's spending most of his time. That's his home base. And he might bump into demands as well. And some of the ice cubes melt faster than others. So like the big ice cubes are bigger demands and the smaller ice cubes are smaller demands. And it's kind of, to the kid, it kind of feels random and unpredictable, just like life.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
That was an extremely thorough answer. I appreciate it. Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Can I ask? I'm going to ask a few follow-up questions, and I like
sure.
trying to take notes. Okay, I want you to go back to the assessment component, and okay. I want you to, can you explain a little bit why in that moment that we're reinforcing that negative behavior? Because I think you made a really smart comment in the start of like, yeah, we know teachers know what to do, right? They know what to do to stop the behavior, but we're afraid to do it because of this mindset like, oh, I can't reinforce the negative behavior, right? I can't give him the iPad. He didn't earn it. So in that moment and kind of speaking to that mindset, why are we then, oh, okay, cool, go back to your iPad. You don't want to do it. Why are we doing that? What is the point of that process?
The point of that process is, I mean, the first point of that process is to maintain safety. So we know that if we don't reinforce it, if we don't allow the kid to go back to what they were doing and take that demand away, the kid might escalate into severe dangerous problem behavior. So that's the first answer. But the answer for why it's okay is because of the matching law. So if we just do this occasionally and we're also reinforcing those smaller, lower effort problem behaviors, and we're incrementally teaching skills that we're then reinforcing down the line, we're still going to be able to successfully shape that behavior into what we want to see. Even if we're sometimes reinforcing that problem behavior. Is that helpful?
Yeah, do less ABA. Say it in like how you'd say it to a teacher or like a para. Like, explain the matching law. That's a great point. So explain what that means. Like, give an example even. Like Johnny did this. Am I putting you on the spot here? Sorry.
Yeah, let me think. Do you have a good answer for that?
Yeah, I mean – as somebody who previously was in a school BCBA role only, right? Like, I think that we really value like holding the line, but in my guess, I think something that I've learned over time is like, we can hold that line, but only for so long, and it will get to severe problem behavior. And we ultimately end up having to reinforce physical aggression that did tissue damage, self-injury that left a bruise. And if we know like, when they give these precursor vocalizations, or they do that gaze shift where they're looking out of the corner of their eye, or they're tugging on their clothes, or they're doing this hand wringing, if we know that those are the warning signs, physical aggression is coming, why not reinforce those warning signs when we know that they're linked to the more severe problem behavior in the chain? And so I think a lot of people feel like that they need to hold the line. I can't reinforce problem behavior. That's teaching them that they, you know, can engage in problem behavior and get what they want. But ultimately, if we do hold the line, we only have so much control of the environment. We need to maintain safety. We end up in situations that result in restraint and timeout. And so the kid does get reinforcement from that, because during that entire de-escalation time, we're giving attention in some way. There's no demands. And it is a more humane and dignified and safe, respectable way to allow students to opt out and reinforce the warning signs and shape that over time, like Courtney said, yeah, versus waiting till they are highly escalated and distressed, and then we can't hold the line anymore, and then we're reinforcing that. Because then what we're teaching them is that you're right, your behavior has power, but in order for me to hear you, you need to hurt yourself or others, yeah, for me to hear you.
Yes, that's like exactly what I was thinking, because I'm thinking to that point you made that you just said too, like, we're taught hold the line, we're taught don't do this, but in reality, we're going to be reinforcing these behaviors anyways. And I'm, and, you know, just kind of thinking from a staff training buy-in perspective on explaining that, right?
Yes.
So you kind of touched on this in your description, which really appreciate how thorough that was of PFA and SBT, but on some of the differences between those traditional behavior responses. And are there any other important differences that you've seen using this model using versus those kind of traditional behavior responses that we've seen?
Yeah. So I think like a lot of our school-based interventions, right, they really heavily rely on that antecedent or proactive intervention, reinforcement systems, teaching kind of what's expected or unexpected, or thumbs up, thumbs down, coping skills, so the child can tolerate things that are aversive, or that those DRO interventions, so differential reinforcement of other behavior. That's the way a lot of our token boards and reinforcement systems work. You need to have quiet hands, and when you get your 5 stars, you can have what you want. So as long as you don't engage in physical aggression and you fill up your token board, you can have what you want. School-based interventions also tend to focus on function and isolation, or primary function. So we're doing an FBA for all these different target behaviors. Self-injury is just for attention, but physical aggression is for escape. And that results in really complex behavior plans with all these targets with different functions. And that makes it incredibly challenging for staff to respond to problem behavior, because in the moment, if you're getting self-injury and you're getting physical aggression, well, it's for escape and attention. So I'm supposed to give you a break, but then also maybe ignore you. And so I think then we over-rely on those reinforcement systems. So like what Courtney talked about, like we're dangling the carrot and we're trying to motivate them essentially out of problem behavior. And I think that's a common experience for us in public schools. But in the long term, that doesn't solve the problem for kids with severe problem behavior. As Dr. Greg Hanley says, the path to freedom from problem behavior is skills. He really emphasizes in that initial 10-hour the practical functional analysis and skills-based treatment modules. So if you take the level one or the introduction, it's 10 hours of modules online, that severe problem behavior is multiply controlled. So it's not just escape, it's not just attention. There aren't really functions in isolation for kids who have really entrenched problem behavior. I think he gives the example that nobody escapes to nothing. Nobody aggresses just for a little bit of attention. And he kind of summarizes that kids engage in severe problem behavior because they want to get out of what they don't want to do in order to interact with others in their preferred way and have access to all their preferred items and activities. So it's all the things. And that severe problem behavior can really meet all the functions for a learner. And that's what you're targeting in that synthesized reinforcement context that Courtney talked about. Like, we're bringing the joy to kids with their preferred interaction. We're not placing demands on them, and we're letting kids lead within preferred activities. So even if their play includes stereotypy or they have unusual interests, we're going to let kids come as they are and engage with them in those preferred ways. Education can really be a compliance-based system in a lot of ways. And you know, like we talked about, like so often we're taught to hold the line, but that's not really serving us right now. And there's a lot of changes that are needed when meeting those needs of complex behavioral needs of our learners.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the behaviors are usually multiply controlled, but it's also through the process, you tie all of the problem behaviors together. So you have the severe problem behaviors laid out, and you also have those precursor or milder behaviors laid out. So when you're a school and you're talking about how are we going to treat this behavior, you're also able to tie those problem behaviors all into a neat little bundle and say they're all multiply controlled by multiple functions. And it makes the planning process just a whole heck of a lot easier when you don't have to do, you don't have to treat each problem behavior as separate.
So you're learning to respond to the warning signs and not the, so you're learning to respond to the reward. Yeah, start over again. So you're learning to respond to the warning signs and not the physical aggression and the self-injury. Like you hope if you understand the warning signs well, that you can reinforce and respond to that versus getting to those points of escalation that are unsafe.
The point on multiply controlled is so key. I saw Dr. Hanley maybe now 10 years ago, the same course that you're talking about do in person. And when he started talking about that, I had like the biggest light bulb moment, maybe you guys too, because it was always writing behavior plans as a behavior analyst so hard for me. Like it's a little bit of all of it. I don't know, you know, like there's some of this, there's some of that, and then it changes. And then, oh my gosh, now I have to train staff on this like ever changing behavior plan that the function keeps switching. So just from a clear, like simplicity standpoint, it makes it so much more approachable for a team to create that comprehensive plan.
No, I agree. Taking that traditional ABC data for kids with severe problem behavior, when you graph it, it's always all over the place. And you're like, okay, you can see elements of everything, but what am I going to say is primary? Is it a little bit more escape? Is it a little bit more attention? Times, then they have like five target behaviors in their plan. And then we have to get staff to try to carry out really complex things and respond based on individual functions to specific behaviors. And that's really challenging.
Yeah, it just becomes a mess. And you're right, with those kind of that traditional like ABC data, there's also always an attention component because an adult's involved, but you don't know if it's really attention. It's just, it gets messy quickly. And I think this simplifies it in such a, in a way that makes sense too.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, if you look in the school setting and you look at a typical problem behavior we'd see of elopement, like, of course, in the school setting, they're always getting attention just because we have to maintain safety.
Exactly.
But that could be a red herring because it's just something that's always there.
Yeah, exactly. So you're like, oh, I just took all this data that was also, by the way, super time consuming to take. Mm-hmm. And now I don't even know what to do with it. So you're just kind of stuck. You're like,
or you go and observe and you don't see any problem behavior. And then you feel pressure because how can I make recommendations when I haven't seen it happen? And this process lets you back up a little bit and just really trust the providers. They're professionals. They know the kid too. And they can fill you in and then you can trust them and make recommendations from there.
I think that first piece of the interview really right away builds rapport between the consultant, the behavior analyst, whoever's that person coming in, and the teachers and the para, the ones that are like, you know, they're on the war lines, whatever. They're the ones in the trenches, like doing it. And that it starts out with like, not like, let me watch what you're doing wrong, but like, hey, let me learn from you what's going on. It creates this like really great dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what motivated your district to move towards this model versus continuing with those traditional behavior interventions?
Yeah, I'll say these two brilliant women on this call with me are part of the reason that we're moving this direction. Over the past 10 years or so, we have experienced a significant rise in severe problem behavior in the school setting, like other districts across the country. And we had tried all the traditional behavioral analysis and interventions, and continued to experience not only the rise in frequency and intensity, but we also saw the impact of short-term gains that we would make with a student being lost then as that student transitioned from level to level. And we had school staff, administrators, families saying to us, what are we going to do? We have to do something different. We had staff getting injured at much higher rates than previously before, and we had classrooms evacuated, et cetera. Courtney, who was on our team at the time, had attended a conference and had heard about Dr. Hanley's work and PFA and SBT. She came back to me and said, can I attend a training and try it with a student? I said, absolutely, yes. And we saw success right away. And then Megan joined the district and the two of them really convinced me to pilot with a larger group of students and staff. And that really, truly, I think when you see it work, you say, how can we not do this?
Mm-hmm. That's so amazing. I mean, I love the process too of like, let's try this with one kid and it's working. Let's try it with more. And this like really organic, like ripple effect.
Absolutely.
How did you get buy-in? Did you have trouble getting buy-in from different school settings from this? Or what was that process on? Yeah, like you see it. Okay, I want to do it too. But were there any other obstacles on getting buy-in for this process?
Absolutely. I'll be honest about that. It's something we're still, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. I'll be honest about that. I mean, it is something we're still working on is the buy-in piece. I do think once you see it, you believe it. We had, one school that was piloting with several students, and by, I think, day three, someone was emailing me saying, for the first time, I am so full of hope.
Oh,
and
wow.
So it's getting people over that initial hump of this is a lot of work. Prior to engaging with PFASBT and the pilots that we're doing, we did start with the rationale for a need to change our practices. We've talked with staff about the fact that kids are different today, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Also, when we know better, we do better. And so we had to really start with the why. What are our core values that guide our decision-making around responding to problem behavior? What are our guidelines and our core values about how we're going to work with students, how we're going to work with our families? So we created and implemented these humanistic behavior core values as a system. And then we implemented professional learning, beginning with our administrators and our student services staff. And I think we got buy-in along the way as to the why we needed to do something different. We still certainly have some challenges for people that believe in the very old school planned ignoring, those kind of practices. And I will tell you that one turning point for me as a leader is Dr. Hanley came and gave learning to our team. And at one point he looked at me and said, when a student is struggling with behavior and you're called in, what do? Do you just go and observe? And I said, well, yeah, I want to see the behavior. And he said, if someone was choking, would you just sit and observe? These students are having a medical crisis to some degree. We need to engage. We need to act and do what we can to stop that from occurring. And so that's really where we went, full scale ahead. And we have now built in some opportunities for staff. We're very lucky and blessed in our district that we have opportunities for staff to move along the pay scale, not just by earning graduate degrees and, postgraduate credit hours, but also we can design learning experiences that help them to move along the pay scale. And so the district has identified PFASBT learning and certification as valuable for increasing the capacity of our staff. And we've put some financial resources behind the certification process, which is improving the buy-in.
That's amazing. I mean, how like for other schools to be able to model that process too of all of that would be so great.
Yeah, it's, I think one thing that we continue to say to ourselves is, if we're going to do something, we have to do it well. And in order to do it well, that's a significant amount of time in learning, in processing, in consultation, in collaboration. And we know that that adds strain to our staff who are already stressed and have too much on their plate. And so if we can also then give them some sort of financial compensation for that extra work, eventually they'll see that it works, right? And they'll want to implement it all the time. But it is that initial buy-in piece that it's helpful. And we're very blessed to be able to do that.
So, I think when we think about some of these types of strategies, you instantly think of like a clinic or maybe in-home setting, and the school's just messy, right? I'm a public school I consider myself a teacher first and a behavior analyst second, because I was a teacher when I became a behavior analyst, and things that I always struggled learning about, I was like, but what about in a school? Like, where logistics rule the world, and like, yes, a staff member would be great, but we don't have one and it's overcrowded. And, there's all these messy dynamics in schools. So what have been some of the biggest challenges of implementing this process specifically in that school setting?
I mean, you nailed it. Those logistics are really like the biggest challenges. It's time, it's space, and it's the people. It's the support that you need to do that. So we had to be really intentional to plan for it. And Lisa's been such a great supporter and cheerleader, and she's doing like absolutely everything we need her to do to really rally for those things that we need. So we've been really lucky in that aspect. The recommended treatment dosage is at least 4 hours a week. So that's 4 hours a week where for most students, you have to do this in a pullout setting. You have to find a space to do that, whether it's an empty classroom, an empty office, getting creative and like, you know, having it like in a part of the library, if there's not other kids in there, whatever you need to do. It does take some creativity and some planning for that. We also have a really steep learning curve, I feel like. Teams started out spending a lot more time on some of those softer things outside of sessions, like graphing, pulling videos, things like that, that we've improved on as we've moved through the process. So on that end, the time commitment has decreased a little bit as we've gotten more familiar, but it's still a pretty hefty commitment, like I said. So finding that time and that space. But I think when you're in the school setting, you always have to balance it out with how much time and how much space am I currently allocating just in response to some of these behaviors, and what could be different if I decided to do things more proactively in a teaching capacity versus just a reactive capacity. So I think that perspective is helpful to have, and that conversation is helpful to have with teams if they're considering going this direction.
I literally had that conversation with someone this morning because they're like, I don't have time for that. And I was like, I want you to like, if I could come in your class and just use a timer every time you were responding to a problem behavior, you probably spend half your day doing that already. So you do have the time. It's just being used in a different way.
Right.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What, right. Especially for Courtney and Megan, what advice do you have for maybe school-based BCBAs or behavior consults or even teachers that are, you know, wanting to bring this into their school, but maybe are not as lucky to have such a supportive as an administrator like Lisa, as you guys do? What advice do you have for those staff members that want to bring this in?
I mean, the first thing I would say, like, learn everything you can about it. FTF has those great modules on their website. They're, I think, fairly affordable. So get like, pull those trainings, do that learning, and then make sure that you're also pulling in whoever you're going to team with, you're pulling them in and making sure they understand the whole process. Cause it's really difficult to loop people in and have them as part of the day-to-day treatment without understanding the bigger picture, because that's when people get stuck. And I think that's how this program got a little bit of a reputation, just being called like Hanley's My Way program. And people are thinking it's just like kids sitting in the corner in a beanbag chair saying my way, and they never have to do anything. I think it's because people have a very short-term, short-sighted view of what the program is. So whoever else you loop in to help you with it, they also need to have that bigger picture. And then you can't do this sort of thing in isolation. So even if you don't have other people doing it in your building or in your district, reaching out for community in other districts, for other BCBAs, there's people online on Facebook who are doing this that are always happy to answer questions. So just making sure that you are reaching out and connecting with other people. And I would say we also learned, don't start with your hardest kid right away. Like if you want that buy-in piece and you want to experience every CAB, every step along the way, another acronym I didn't explain. So a CAB is a contextually appropriate behavior.
You know, so we if all you want to go, I'm sorry. We all wanted new acronyms to learn.
I know. Yeah. So if you want to go through the whole process with a kid and get that full experience, pick one of your kids who has problem behavior, but is not like the worst kid in your district, right? You want to pick a kid who you can experience success with and get better yourself. So then next time you're ready to work with that kid who's a little bit more challenging.
I think that's really the other thing advice.
The other thing I'll add to that too is just, you know, if you don't think your administrator is there yet, like find your people. You know, Megan and Courtney are incredible resources to everyone in our district. They have grown the popularity of this program, boots on the ground every day in the trenches, and they have grown as individuals, and they have grown others because of their dedication. So I think finding other people who are in the trenches with you to partner and say, hey, let's try this, I think that's really key.
Yeah. That's great advice. And sometimes that might be, like you said, going to other schools, you know, so often, especially yep. in rural districts, you're like, God, I have no one else I can collaborate in this building, but what about people in other buildings or other districts?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, let's hear about the successes. I want to hear what's been going well.
I, being an early childhood person, we have a lot of kids who are very early learners. So kiddos who might be more of like that level one VBMAP. And I've had kids grow their language, increase like their social bids, referencing others, spontaneously imitating others in play when they previously even haven't had a repertoire of imitation. And then just expanding their rec and leisure just by participating in that synthesized reinforcement context. So even though I didn't provide direct instruction, like I was able to grow all these skills that I have always struggled with early learners, getting them to engage with others and expand their rec and leisure is always such a big challenge. And some of those things just kind of naturally happened and learners grew just through synthesized reinforcement. There's also learners we've experienced having the My Way be their first vocal manned request. And I think that's really powerful for implementers.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I had thought of another answer, but then I was coming in this morning into work. And then one of the teachers that I've been working with grabbed me and she was like, hey, you know, our student we've been working with came off the bus yesterday morning and he started signing the My Way right away. He went, and I was like, oh my gosh, he wanted to go and practice. Aww. And like those little things, like kids enjoying their school day and like really enriching their school day. That's been a huge success. But I think the biggest success overall is really just showing staff that there's a better way to do things. And we don't have to hold that hard line. We don't have to push kids through really uncomfortable situations. Like before we started doing this, our best hope for kids who had severe problem behavior is like, maybe we can make a plan or some sort of program so we could suppress that behavior in school, like under very certain conditions, under with the right antecedent manipulations in place. And then oftentimes they'd move to junior high or they'd move to the next setting. And then that behavior would just come back because it wasn't gone. You know, we hadn't taken it away out of their repertoire. We just made it so it wasn't popping up under these certain very specific conditions. We were making kids' worlds smaller and smaller by taking away these things that they couldn't handle. Some of those things were things they hated and they couldn't handle them, but other things were those things that they loved and they couldn't handle them. Like maybe a kid really loved Lady Gaga, but we weren't able to play it because he got so jacked up that we couldn't get him to calm down. So now like, oh, I'm sorry, no more Lady Gaga in school. So we would make these kids' worlds smaller and smaller. And then we celebrated that. Like, hey, we're doing great. The data is showing the problem behavior is not happening anymore. But now we have this other way where we can teach the skills so the kid can really manage the environment, tolerate those things that he doesn't like very much, but he needs to do, and also learn to cope and to regulate himself doing these things that he loves to do. And it's just so much more fun for everybody. It's enjoyable for everyone. And it's also just a lot safer for everyone. So I think that's been the biggest celebration is like, there's a different way to do it. And it's a lot better.
I love the very specific examples like Lady Gaga. Like you can, I know that's like a child you've worked with because I always quote like, so I'm like, well, if you want to watch more, you know, like that TV show, there's always specific examples that stick with us.
Yeah.
What have you all learned? You know, you kind of touched on this now, but with that answer just there, but what else have you learned from implementing skills-based treatment and how's it affected your kind of in general demeanor and overall kind of perspective and mindset on working with students?
Yeah. So prior to the school year, like we had played around with SBT a little bit, but we have officially done cohorts this year. So it was really impactful for me. We recorded ourselves, like to watch yourself back and see yourself in action. I feel like I was able to make a lot more changes to instruction by watching myself, but it's pretty vulnerable to do that. That's really challenging for staff. I think I've also really learned to make decisions based on values and to be more flexible. In education, I think teachers can actually be really rigid, and I'm going to include myself in that. So I think I've learned to be more flexible. Also just that students are more capable than we know when we teach in the right context with the appropriate amount of challenge. I've also learned to kind of be more emotionally present with kiddos and more attuned to those precursor or those, they say R2, in SBT. And then just knowing when I can challenge that student, maybe encourage a little bit of persistence versus knowing when I need to pull back and kind of reinforce earlier in that chain. I think one of the more powerful parts of SBT is kind of honoring that assent withdrawal and reinforcing it if you get an instance of problem behavior. and then doing that reflection on why did I get that? Why did that happen? What should I be changing on the next trial? What was the need? What was the child trying to communicate? When we saw Dr. Hanley present in September, he said to be autistic is to lose what you love. Because when you have severe problem behavior, like Courtney talked about, your world just gets smaller and smaller. And that really resonated with me. I think that's the reality for most of our kids with severe problem behavior. We take things away from them because they can't be safe and their world shrinks. As BCBAs, we should be scientists. And so we should be asking why and value more curiosity about our practices and feedback about those practices from those we serve. That's the socially significant part of our practice. And currently ABA as a field has a lot of opportunities for growth in that area, I think.
Really?
Yeah,
good
definitely. Sasha, I was like you, when I first started in this general field, I was a special ed teacher first before I became a BCBA. And I feel like when I was, you know, in my 20s and starting teaching, I felt like, hey, I know everything about this. Like I'm an expert. And then it's just been so much fun to learn like how wrong I was and about like how much there's always so much more to learn. And then like when we started learning about this and implementing this, like it's just every day there's something new to learn. And we are learning from each other and we're learning from the kids. The kids are teaching us every time. Like, hey, when you can tell if a kid's not making progress, like the kid's teaching you something's not working. So let's learn from this kid what's happening, what's not working. My biggest lesson has been like you can teach really powerful, effective skills without pushing through problem behavior or waiting students out until they comply. Compliance and waiting out have become like really big red flag words for me. If I hear staff talking about a kid they're frustrated with or a kid they're problem solving and they talk about he's just not complying or he's non-compliant or they talk about how they have to wait the kid out, like I automatically think, you know, where's the breakdown happening or like how can I problem solve this a little bit differently because there has to be a better plan.
And the waited out like has never worked, which is kind of interesting from a behavioral perspective. Like what has reinforced our behavior on thinking waited out works? Yeah. Because it really doesn't.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. And I, you know, you've even heard like you're waiting, like a kid's not sitting in the chair. You give them the direction and you wait and wait and wait. And if you waste 2 hours and they finally sit in the chair, like, are we going to celebrate that? Like it's, education shouldn't have winners and losers. And I feel like that's what you're doing is like, you want to win and you want the kid to lose. And that doesn't feel good. But we're the grownups. We should think smarter than that.
Yeah. And I think too, like we've learned in this process, like staff really needs to feel that permission that it is okay to meet kids where they're at. They're so focused on, I have to get these academics in, exposure to the general education curriculum and then their IEP goals. And if they're on some sort of alternative assessment and they're, you know, like they want that compliance because they want to be able to get all these things. And so I think it is hard for them to reinforce that problem behavior because they want to make sure that kids are getting progress, get all their things in. So I think we've had to have a lot of values-based conversations with staff about why we reinforce those warning signs and kind of give them permission to sit in like that discomfort and be okay, that they can reinforce those warning signs. And that's not a bad thing to do.
They might be scared. Like, hey, if I tell him to sit down and he doesn't sit down this time, then he'll never respect me as an authority. And I'll never be able to do anything with him again. And like, that's not how it works.
Yeah. I love these huge takeaways that you all have had and how, you know, exactly, I forget who said it, like, you know, we know better, we do better, and we continue to learn and reflect on things that we've done in the past that, you know, we didn't know better then and we do now. So how can we have that change our practice? So that's so, so exciting to hear. So for school, I really hope that this episode encourages especially schools to look into this process, move forward with this process. I know you all mentioned the FTF website. What other resources do you suggest going to for kind of getting this started?
I think starting at the FTF website is where teams need to start. There's a bunch of free resources on that website. There's links to YouTube videos of some of Dr. Hanley's like older presentations. I think that's the best place to start is really with those presentations and those trainings that are really like by the book. Once teams or individuals have a really strong grasp on like what the process looks like, there's a really good Facebook group that offers suggestions. But the Facebook group is usually, it's full of people who have done this a lot And so they're kind of riffing on it sometimes. They're not doing it in like a very scripted, regimented way. And so it's really hard, I think, to start there, because if you don't know the process from A to Z really well, then it's going to be really hard for you to go off script and start kind of improvising. And that's what the Facebook group is more about. Super helpful if you know the process and you're just looking for help for like a certain case, or you're looking for like other outside the box ideas. But I think that's a really hard place to start if you're just getting started with the process.
I would encourage people to, like, I mean, reach out to us or other districts that you know are trying it. Like, there are certain complexities when doing this in a school setting. And so if you're interested in doing that, like, talk to other people who've tried it, what worked, what didn't work. Even our fall pilot to our spring pilot, we made adjustments. We're changing things. We're kind of figuring out which are the best students to be a part of a pilot, and what are the best staff members to complete it, and what all is needed. And some of that comes through practice.
I think too, because the process is very complex, it's hard to visualize. So if you're able to watch any video footage of treatment, I know Upstate Cerebral Palsy, which I believe is now Upstate Caring Partners, does a lot of PFA SBT, and they do have their own YouTube channel that has videos about SBT. And I believe there's some clips that you can watch of treatments, and that might be beneficial to staff as well to get that visual of what it actually looks like to run a session.
Awesome. That's all really good advice. I really agree on the Facebook group. I'm not starting there because it's also all acronyms. And if you don't understand the acronyms yet, thank you all so much. I think this has been not only a great overview really of what PFA and SBT is, if that's new to anyone, but for anyone that's already familiar with it, that's in that school setting, I really appreciate the actionable advice you've given and some of the background and successes and challenges of what's happening in your school district. So thank you all so much for taking the time to share this process with everyone.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's truly been an honor to talk about it, honestly. And so we're very grateful that you're shedding light on this topic.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Autism Helper podcast. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, hit subscribe. It would mean a lot to me if you left some feedback. Whether I'm working one-on-one with a student, doing a podcast like this one, or presenting for a PD, my goal is always to provide as much value as I can. So your feedback really helps me make sure I'm doing just that. If you have other topics you'd like me to cover, leave in the feedback or message me on social media. You can follow me at The Autism Helper on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Pinterest, or visit my website, theautismhelper.com. Thanks again for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VBMAP and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum. Everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.